Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Juan San Miguel, and we are going to be talking about Among Others by Joe Walton, which won the 2012 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Juan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, Juan, why don't you, I know that you've been a listener of the show for a while, and we've connected on Twitter, but why don't you kind of tell my audience something about yourself?
Well, I consider myself an active fan since 1987, since that's when I went to my first Worldcon at 16, and I've only missed three since then. I've just been to the recent one in Dublin.
Nice.
I mean, I've been a fan of SF in some form or another. I in my teens, I got seriously into books, and I'm still seriously into books, but I also do other media too. I mean, as I said, just like we were talking about, I went to a panel about all the Hugo Best Dramatic Presentation long form winners we were talking about just before. And I try to follow up, and I've been regularly voting for the Hugo for years, and it's been an interesting change. I mean, a lot of changes. I mean, in the 90s, we actually started, that was the first time we got, particularly for short fiction, you could get people would put their stuff up on the web. And now that's evolved into the Hugo packet. If you pay $50 for your supporting fee for the Worldcon, that gives you access to the Hugo packet, which gives you digital copies of almost everything, of all the categories, with the exception of Best Dramatic Presentation categories.
Right.
And I've seen the process. I've looked at how the sausage is made, so
right.
I can answer any questions about that. And again, I was very active. When you were asking me to pick one, I think I wanted to pick a year that I definitely had memories about, so that's why we picked this one.
Okay.
And also, it's actually a very mellow book, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah. Now, when you found this podcast, it spurred you to do something.
Oh, yes, I forgot about that. Well, when I was a teenager and started, I'm going to start reading science fiction, the Hugo, you just heard about the Hugos. I heard about the Hugos. I think it was on the cover of a Star Trek novel, because Star Trek won two Hugos in the classic series. So this would have been the early 80s.
Sure.
And I said, okay, these Hugos, what are they? And then Asimov had published two Hugo anthologies for short fiction. And so that's where you could find the list. So I decided, okay, let's take a look at the list of best novels. And I just went through as many as I could. And that's where I read a big bulk of them. And this was in the mid 80s, so it was probably about 30 books at that point.
Yeah.
And I read all the Heinlein, I read the Demolished Man. Trying to think of the other books. So that's where I went through. And then there's some books that were just out of print and I couldn't get my hands on, so I just let it go by the wayside. And then when I started actively, I read most of the books for each year that I was actively involved in. But then when your show came on, I counted how many books I hadn't read, and I realized I still had fingers left over. So I decided to get off and find it. I mean, the hardest book to find was This Immortal by Roger Zelazny. I live near the University of Central Florida, where I got my master's, and I'm an alumnus now, so I had to sign a paper. They actually had an old hardback copy of it, and that was the last one I read. But because of that, I finally got around to reading Stand on Zanzibar. There was one of the Vorxigian books that I missed, Mirror Dance, Hyperion, and a few others on the way that, I just had missed. I mean, I even have a copy. I'm kind of curious when you get to do this on your show. They'd Rather Be Right. I found a copy at a giant used book sale in Washington and got it for $5. So I can't wait to hear that one, because it's hard to find, and also it's not that popular of a book.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one as well. So, no, I think you're one of maybe only one or two people who I've had on who have read everything. So I think it's possible that one of my other guests did, and I've had a couple other who were close. But
now there are a few that I don't remember as clearly as I do. Actually, I'd rather read. I think it was called The Big Time by Fritz Lieber. I want to reread that again. Although I reread The Wanderers, that was a book. That was actually a weird book. I don't want to spoil it for whoever's going to get the fun to do that book.
Right.
But it was just it's not a bad book. It's just, it's kind of an interesting book. I'll let if somebody's picked that, let them talk about it.
Right. Definitely. Yeah, on the last episode, I thought that I had gotten to halfway on my reading, and then realized that I hadn't accounted for the 2019 winners. And so now I'm halfway. I'm 37 out of 74 titles, including the Retro Hugos. So
it's 74 titles, right? Well, I forgot about ties.
Yeah, there's I think there's only one tie, but
no, three.
Oh, are there?
Let me make sure. Oh yeah, it's definitely three. Dune and Disimmortal tied.
Oh, that's right.
The Doomsday Book and Fury Upon the Deep tied.
Okay.
And recently, and I was actually in this, I remember somebody actually waited for a paper ballot to come in to make sure it would still keep the tie. The City and the City and the Wind-Up Girl tied.
Right. Okay. I guess I need to revisit the list. Well, why don't we talk specifically about this book? Why did you choose this one? You hinted at it, but maybe more detail.
Well, part of the reason was, as I said, I think only Olaf was the only one who's actually been an active participant in the Hugo voting,
right,
of your guests. Not that there's anything wrong with not participating, but I thought, okay, let me get a year that I'm fresh on that's still available. And when I looked at it, I go, well, among others, God, that was a really nice book. And the thing is, I'd have to reread it. I reread it weeks ago and just took down some notes to get some important things done. Hopefully we can keep this conversation going for it. But it's just it's a nice book. I first encountered it, I think John Scalzi's blog. He does a blog called A Big Idea to help promote other writers, and I think he let Joe Walden write up about this.
Okay.
And I definitely had it. One of the things I do with my local club is that on January I do a presentation of the best books that came out in the previous year, and I research. There's some websites that I find, and I try to correlate lists, and I usually come up with about 25 books. And to me, it's a victory I've been actually pretty successful for doing this for 5 or 6 years, that I've predicted both the Nebula and the Hugo winner.
Oh, nice.
It was one of the books that I selected. And I definitely selected this because, and I guess we can enter into conversation, when I first described this book to somebody during that talk, it goes, well, where's the science fiction in it? And then somebody pointed out that I did mention the fantastical element that comes into it, actually early on. But when I describe the book, I'm describing another aspect of the book, which we'll talk about in a minute. And So I definitely remember that's how I encountered it. It was in my top best list, and I'm pretty sure that I did see it on the whatever big idea list.
Right. Well, on that note, why don't we kind of dive into talking about just a kind of a quick non-spoiler synopsis of the book, if that's even possible.
I think it's easy. I mean, the elevator pitch, it's about a young teenage girl who's just recovered from trauma. Her twin has died, and her mother was a source of that trauma. And she's trying to readjust her new life with her father and going to a new school. And what gets her through the day is being a science fiction fan and science fiction reader and general reader. Mm-hmm. And describing it, I just didn't mention a fantastic element. The incident was that her mother tried to take over the fairy kingdom, and she and her sister put a stop to it. And one of the things that's unique about this book, that Joe Walton mentioned it, she wanted to do the afterwards, what happens after the big event, and make that into an event itself.
Yeah, it's kind of like this book is an epilogue to a larger fantasy story.
Right. Oh, and she just wanted to deal, I guess, with the post-trauma of it.
Yes.
And, you know, it's about Morwenna. I'm trying to read my notes here, read my handwriting, who's Welsh. And, you know, she's a big book fan, and that's part of her recovery, or part of her dealing with what's happened is, and she talks about all the books she reads and then her interactions with friends.
Yeah. Well, kind of going into overall thoughts about this one, this is a first time read for me. There's a few times in this book, because it's so kind of hyper literate in science fiction, that it left me behind a little bit, just because there's, you know, I'm still trying to become well read in science fiction. And Joe Walton, of course, has this encyclopedic knowledge of science fiction. She actually, I'm not sure if she still does the tor.com column, but I know that anytime I've looked for research on any of the Hugo winners, there's almost always a post from her.
No, she doesn't do the column. I think there's two reasons why she stopped. One, when she stopped, it was 10 years before the current year.
Okay.
And she felt you can't really evaluate a classic within 10 years or less than 10 years.
Sure.
The other problem is that when she also stopped, I think she was entering her own professional career. Mm. And so now she'd be talking about peers.
Right.
She was probably, she might have been talking, I don't know if she was talking about peers before then, but now she's, you know, at this point she started being a professional writer. So, you know, I think that was the two reasons why she stopped it.
Yeah.
At where she did. And she might take it up again. Actually, she is taking up a new thing where she just talks about everything she reads in a month.
Oh, wow.
And it's not just science fiction and fantasy. It's also historical and other material.
Okay. Well, I know this book is also kind of semi-autobiographical because she's Welsh-Canadian, and I believe she went to a boarding school, and she's been an avid reader since she was young.
Yeah, and her Locus interview, she discussed, the similarities and differences between the real life and what happened in the book. I don't know if she's half Canadian. She immigrated to Canada. I believe she lives in Montreal now.
Yeah. That's what I mean by Welsh Canadian. She lives in Canada now, but she's from Wales. It's in this book, she sets it up as an unreliable narrator at the beginning, where she's like, "You won't believe this anyway." You know, call it a fairy story if that helps you. You know, which so in reading it, I was always kind of like, "Am I supposed to be taking all this literally, or is this just a girl dealing with trauma?" But so it's.
I thought it was a letter.
Yeah. It kind of is.
Because I think Morwenna is very sincere and she's, you know, generally a nice person. I think and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just popping into my head. She's, you know, kind of towards herself. I mean, she's been through this thing and she has to go through a new boarding school and, you know, she's, you know, trying to figure out who's cool, for lack of a better word, who's cool and who's not cool.
Right.
So she's kind of into herself and is slowly, you know, becoming more outgoing. I mean, particularly by the end of the book, she's, you know, starting a relationship with someone. So I think she's saying, you know, I think she's trying to say this is fantastical. Because I guess, like, well, when I sum up the book, I mean, I almost keep forgetting that there is a fantasy element to this. And I think she's just trying to element that this is fantastical. But I don't think Morwenna is deliberately trying to lie to us. Now, there is an incident where the Fae, which gets disorienting, and I don't think she trusts what she saw, if you agree with that.
Yeah. So, like, if you were going to recommend this novel, is there anything else on the Hugo list that you'd recommend as kind of companion reading with it, or anything else in the genre, or even not in the genre?
The first thing that comes to mind is Fallen Angels, only because by Larry Niven, Jerry Pournelle, and...
I've actually read that one.
And Michael Flynn. The only reason I recommend that is because, like this, it's a show of love of science fiction and science fiction fans doing something. And that's the first thing that pops into my head. And I can't think of any big thing of a novel length. I think there's some stuff in the short fiction area. There's one story that's just kind of tangential. But it's, you know, fans doing good. That's the first thing that comes. In the Hugo nominees, it's hard. I can't think of anything. I mean, I think this is the first book which is kind of self-referential that at least has won.
Right. It mentions the Hugo Award specifically.
Well, yeah, it was kind of sad when I reread this because I forgot about this, this takes place in 1978, creeping into 79, and she missed out. The 78 Worldcon was in Brighton, which, as one of her friends mentions, you know, he got to go to. You know, and she could have been able to get to had she known about it, you know, and it was those days when, you know, no internet. And she actually, Joe wouldn't have probably watched, if they even had, I don't think they had TV advertisements, and Joe is notoriously anti-media, if you've read her columns.
I haven't enough to know that, so.
Oh, yeah, I think the thing is, if you read her Hugo columns, if you get to the point where it's best dramatic presentation, she's almost very dismissive of it. I mean, if you notice, she never talks about, 1978 was a big year for Doctor Who. Tom Baker was the Doctor, although some people felt because of the way that the show was being made, he was allowed to be a little bit over the top. Mm-hmm. And before he left, they tried to pull him back. And, you know, she never talks about Doctor Who, and not to mention the year before, Star Wars. I mean, she does talk about Star Wars, but if you notice, she says, yeah, Star Wars, you know, it happened.
Yes.
And, you know, she's not into it, you know, whereas everybody, I think, else at the time, I mean, we were all counting. I mean, actually, that 78 Worldcon, I think they actually, since they They were either in the process of filming or filming. There was a fan who worked in Lucasfilm. I'm trying to find a word. I'm blanking out on a word. Promotions, or somebody who worked in the PR department actually brought, I think a model snow speeder to show up at the Worldcon.
Nice.
So, Yeah, and as I said, she's more books. I mean, I actually wrote a ton of her reference down of all the stuff that she read, including stuff that I hadn't read. Amber was still going on. I think we were in the middle of Amber coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Babel 17, you know, came out in the 60s. And of course the Pern books the new Pern books. And she talked about Brunner's Shockwave Rider and Stand on Zanzibar, which is kind of incredible. I don't know if you've read either of those, but I just read Stand on Zanzibar, which is a very intense book. And she also read Silverberg's Up the Line, and she was talking about Dune, which was
right.
Still going strong. I mean, I always considered Dune to be the book of the 1960s, because it completely dominated, and would continue to dominate. And I guess still dominated because somebody wants to spend millions of dollars to make another movie out of it.
Yep. That's true enough. Kind of going back to recommendations for this one really isn't like much else that I've read. I mean, the fact that it's set in a boarding school and Harry Potter set in a boarding school does not really make them similar novels. And the fact that they're both fantasy doesn't really match up there. So I've really struggled to come up with any kind of comp for it.
No, I guess you can't think of a comp for it. I mean, maybe I think that was one of the two factors. And maybe towards the end, I'll talk about what the other factor was of, why it did so well. I mean, it also won the Nebula. I mean, it
right.
And I'd have to double check. It probably won the Locus Award for either fantasy or science fiction. I'd have to check on that. I'm not sure about that. I don't follow the Locus Awards as closely.
Okay. Well, how about we go ahead and move into spoiler talk, just so we can talk about anything you want to.
Sure. But there's no big twists in this. I mean, the majority of it is just about, her coping. There's a little bit where she gets drawn back into fairies and it looks like it's kind of dangerous, but she's kind of comes back and then she focuses on, trying to make the best life she can for her. And, she's and discovering the science fiction group, where she has a safe space for people who can talk about stuff that she's into, which is, kind of a relief, particularly in those back pre-internet days. I mean, sometimes you felt like you're the loneliest. And that's where the importance of cons are really important because you found your safe space where you could talk about stuff that, the general public wasn't really into.
Right. Right. And it was, she meets this handsome kid named Wim, I guess. I always thought of him as Vim just because I used to work with a Dutch guy named Vim. But, he's jealous of her despite all the disadvantages that she's had, the fact that, she's kind of being raised now by her father who she doesn't even know. And, her twin has died, but she has connections in science fiction with her father. And Wim is like, I don't have that. My dad criticizes me if I read this kind of stuff, thinks it's childish.
Well, yeah. And is Wim the one who goes to both Worldcon and EasterCon, or was that somebody else in the group?
No, I believe it was him. I know that he had gone to Worldcon.
Okay. And EasterCon, for those who don't know, that's the British National Convention.
Right.
It's always held on Easter because apparently I found this out a few months ago that apparently you can get great rates for a hotel on Easter.
Because
I guess everybody's doing Easter things. So that's why it's called EasterCon.
Huh.
And also a Hugo connection. For years, Easter would be the weekend that they would announce the finalists. The shortlist. John Scalzi kind of, because before he became a full-time writer, worked in newspapers and stuff like that. And it's kind of prodded the Worldcon, like, guys, if you do it on the weekend, like on a Saturday or Sunday, the newspaper staffs are out, they've got their C crew there. And, if you want, and also all news agencies, everybody's kind of on their downtime. So if you want maximum publicity, you got to do it in the middle of the week. Right. Or your A game, and they've been trying to do that. I think this year, they did it on in early April, and I know it was in the middle of the week because I actually took time off work to go on my personal laptop and hit when the download came out so I could check out. They made a video of people in Dublin, announcing the finalists.
Nice.
So I'm kind of, yeah, I forgot about that. To me, I thought she was more envious of Wynn because he got to go and, you know, got to go to these cool cons and, you know, get to meet, you know, the pros.
Well, she definitely was envious of that, right? That he got to actually meet Robert Silverberg, I believe, and a couple other people. Vonda McIntyre, I think. And
oh yeah, Vonda was definitely at Brighton. She won the Hugo for Dream Snake there.
Oh, nice. Huh. See, that's interesting having the insider knowledge on that kind of stuff that I just don't have.
I've just got a goofy memory and I can remember stuff like that. And Silverberg, Silverberg hasn't missed the Worldcon since 1952.
Hmm. Well, so one thing, the thing that I wrote down a minute ago that I asked you to wait for a second was, you know, to talk about your experience at the 2012 Worldcon. I mean, you have that insider knowledge, right?
Oh yeah. Well, that was Chicago, and the thing about Chicago is it's the Hilton Hotel, which I call the Two Towers because you've got one tower and another tower, and they've got a big convention space underground, and they're actually bidding again for 2022. Hmm. The only thing is we have to go back to Labor Day weekend rather than the middle of August because that's the only time they can get cheap hotel rooms.
Okay.
If they go back to Labor Day weekend. We went away from Labor Day weekend, to be honest. One of the main reasons was, I think, because Dragon Con was the same weekend. And we thought, let's move it off. Dragon Con, Labor Day was a traditional Worldcon weekend, and then they moved it to... And then Dragon Con, they claimed that they needed to get that time because I think at that time it was a very dead time and they could get good rates. And so they moved it to Labor Day weekend, and for a bunch of years they were at side by side. But then since I think the last Labor Day weekend Worldcon was in 2013, so we might not have another one until 2012. Do you want me to talk about the other nominees or finalists that year, or do you want to wait for that?
Yeah, go for it, man. It's your show.
Well, don't say that. It's it's your show. I'm trying not to ruin it. It was an interesting year. The only thing is, and I'm probably going to get in trouble saying this on such a public forum, I'm kind of an outlier with the Song of Ice and Fire. So that was one of the nominees, A Dance with Dragons. George put a section, I think in 1997 or 96, he put all of Daenerys' stuff from the first book and made it into a novella, and that actually got nominated and won the Hugo. And I remember reading it, and I just, for whatever reason, I might have been in a bad mood that day, I just bounced off on it. So I've never gotten into it, and I don't have HBO, so I haven't seen the series.
Right.
But what other stuff that was on the ballot, Deadline by Mira Grant, a.k.a. Shauna McGuire, which was a continuation of her zombie series, and it was more a science fiction zombie series, and I liked it more because it's not as depressing as The Walking Dead. And
right.
I can't remember where it is in that series, but essentially it's in the future. There was a zombie apocalypse, but people were smart about it. And although civilization didn't completely collapse, we lost a lot of people, and we're now into this new, at that time, blogging culture where bloggers have legal status, and they're, depending on what type of blog you write, that shows you what kind of level of journalist you are. Hmm. And there's some type of conspiracy. And the thing is, the threat still exists. You can still get infected and go shambling. And that exists. And that's the world that Shannon created. And it's about an adopted brother and sister and how they navigate through this world. Hmm. And then you also have Embassy Town by China Mayville, China Mayville writes great books, but with me, it's either going to be super very dense, which is hard to get into, and something easygoing. And this one was a little bit more challenging. It's the idea of an alien race who has this. I haven't read this in a while, so if I get some details wrong, please forgive me. But it's about an alien race of a very complicated way of communicating, and I think it's because it requires two people for it, and. Mm. Or two beings, and they somehow symbiote, and it was a very complicated thing on logistics. I mean, it was a great idea, but it's just it was just very hard. You had to really focus on that book. And then you have Leviathan Wakes by James S. Corey, which I remember writing a book review. Actually, I think I wrote a book review for Among Others, too, for my club news zine. But Leviathan Wakes, it kind of blew me away. I mean, it was good action adventure. I know a lot of people don't like that book, but I kind of like, this is the first book of The Expanse, and in the book, right. I really like how they contracted Holden, who has this belief that information has to be free. You got to put it out there. And Miller, who's a little bit more reserved, knows you can't put all the information until we figure out what's going on.
Right.
And I feel that that book was a struggle between the two of them. And then when they meet, you know, there's kind of like a clash and they're trying to figure out the problem. And it was the beginning of The Expanse, which I, and then actually was kind of, I, as much as I liked the book, I waited 3 years to catch up on the other books until I found out they had a TV series and goes, oh, I better read all these books so I can be cool like those Game of Thrones fans who who already read the books and know what's going to happen on the TV right. show.
I kind of did the opposite. I read the first one. I don't think I read it after I saw the series, but I have not read any of the other ones, and I've been keeping up on the series, on the television series.
Well, the series is pretty faithful. I mean, they make yeah. changes here and there, and the two guys who write the book, Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank, you know, are really in, they claim that they're more into the series. They work more on the series than George works on his series. Mm. And it's faithful, and they make changes where they need to do, and yeah. so you don't change the nature of the book.
Yep.
But the books are fine, and particularly since they're going to wrap it up either this year or next year, they've got one more book to come out.
Okay. Well, so in spoiler talk, you know, it's just whatever we want to talk about. One thing that stuck out to me was she used this term, Karras or Karras, K-A-R-A-S-S, which I guess is a group of like-minded people, you know, kind of a clan, kind of a group, where she had at some point used some magic to create this group or to find a group for her. And then when she finds it, it's this science fiction book club at the library. And it was fascinating to me the way then she thought all the way around that about, wait, what if this didn't exist before I did the magic for it? What if I conjured it? And it's kind of solipsistic, you know, where she's like, I'm the only thing I can verify is actually true. Because of course, magic can work outside of normal boundaries of time, right? And so the idea that she could do this magic in 1979 and it causes someone to, you know, start working at a library, start a book club there. I don't know. It was an interesting idea to me.
Oh, God. I think she talked about I kind of didn't focus on that. Because I thought she's also doubting whether it's true or not and just right. wondering if it just happened. And I guess I was going with Occam's razor on that it just, you know, because she's living in this magical world. She doubts what is and what isn't magic.
Yeah.
And, you know, she respects magic and she wants to be part of magic, but at the same time from a distance, I mean, there's that one of the scenes that I wrote there of how absolutely terrified she was that her aunts from her father's side wanted to have her ears pierced and she was afraid right. that would cut her off from the magic. And the terror of that was just really palpable in the fact yeah. that she was freaking out. But at the same time, she wants to distance herself from the magic because she also knows that magic has this really negative aspect. I mean, since we're in spoiler territories, I mean, she thinks she killed, I forget if he was a corrupt cop or not a nice cop.
Right. By dropping a comb into a bog.
Yeah, and, you know, she was wondering whether she was responsible for that as yeah. well, you know. And maybe that is the unreliable narrator or, you know, she just doesn't know. I don't think she's fully clear of what, you know, certain things happen because is it magic or is it just coincidence?
Right.
But you also know that magic exists because there's that scene where I think during her time off she goes into the field and has that incident with the fairy, which is kind of really trippy. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, so there's more than one, because there's the one where she goes with Wim, and they see the beautiful lady who essentially tells her you need to go back to Wales.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she tries to take Wim so he could kind of believe and, you know, try to believe the crazy stuff that she sees.
Yeah.
Did she have to go back to Wales because of her grandfather? Was that the reason?
I don't remember what the actual reason was. I mean, it was... When she goes back to Wales, and this gets to the kind of what you would call the thrilling climax of the book, which just takes a couple pages where she finally has the confrontation with her mother, even though, you know, throughout the book, her mother's been sending her letters and trying to work magic against her. And Morwenna has been trying to protect herself by whatever way she can, whatever magical way she can, like not getting her ears pierced and, and cutting herself off from magic. And so they have this confrontation, and it's almost an anticlimax, because by then Morwenna has learned enough to go, you know what, she can't hurt me. And she almost just kind of brushes her mom off. And that's where the book does kind of feel like epilogue, because you're like, well, we didn't necessarily establish what kind of magical abilities Morwenna had. But when it comes to that, I completely accepted it. And I thought it was quite a thrilling scene, actually, even though there's not a bunch of action in it. But yeah, the fairies had said, you need to go back here. And then she had to, almost kind of in a Joseph Campbell way, kind of had to refuse the call, because the fairies were offering her a way to join her sister as more or less a ghost, or becoming one of the fairy.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I feel bad. That part doesn't stick out as much into me. Because I guess to me, I'm focusing on her readjustment and, you know, trying to get away from it. And I kind of like that, you know, she is able to stand up to her mother. And she's able to stand up to a lot of people. I mean, that's the thing. She, you know, she becomes more confident as the book goes on. And yeah, she's a more secure person. I mean, since we're in spoiler territory, we can talk about it. I mean, in the 70s, it must have been very, progressive or forward thinking that, you know, she's thinking about, you know, going on birth control, because right, she's considering, even though she's not in a sexual relationship, she's thinking about, you know, maybe going into a sexual relationship, and she wants to, and she's taking it very seriously, mm-hmm, you know, in that time, you know, and I don't think she might have been able to do that at the beginning of the book, but I think towards the end, you know, she's got the confidence to face, you know, to talk to a doctor about it and not, you know, fear the repercussions.
Yeah.
And not to mention that confronting her mother, I mean, the thing is, I think the scary thing with her mother, it happened off screen, you know, in between the prologue and, you know, when she's shipped off to be with her dad. Mm-hmm. So I don't think her mom can scare her as much as possible.
Right.
And at the same time, she does know, unfortunately, you know, that how the world works, that dead is dead. And, you know, the only, you know, there might not be a really good way to be in, you know, with her sister again, which she was very close to.
Yeah.
So she's able, you know, to fight that off, or fight the temptation of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so one of the other things in this book is that oftentimes in fantasy, you are shown, you know, the fairy as being very fair, right? Elves are these beautiful, you know, immortal creatures in Tolkien, right? Where here, they're much earthier, much closer to nature, and a lot of them are more what we would term gnomes, because they're kind of gnarly and warty and just earthy looking. I thought that was fascinating. And then, but this is, you know, Morwenna, she just calls them the fairy because she doesn't know what else to call them. But then when she finally gets her boyfriend to see them, he just thinks they're ghosts. And we never really get an answer to that. It sounds like some of them are. Some of them used to be living. But yeah, I don't know. That was interesting.
Well, they look unearthly. I mean, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a trend in fantasy to try to back away from the Tinkerbell version of fairy.
Right.
And, you know, show a darker side of it. Shauna Maguire is doing that in her Toby, her October Day. Yeah, her Toby Day stories, October Day. Hmm. And I kind of like those stories too. It makes it more complex. You know, they're not all pretty and, you know, gentle and whatever. Although I never thought of Tolkien's elves as fairy. I just think of them as these really, you know, scary warrior types who are going to fight, right, you know, going to fight orcs. You know, they never had that dainty look about them.
Hmm. Except for Orlando Bloom.
Well, I think in the book, Tolkien's, the elves are always like, it was always implied the elves are these powerful creatures. You know, they're the most powerful race in Middle Earth.
Right.
And, you know, they were the leading race in Middle Earth, but they're on the decline. And, you know, it's time for the men to shoulder up their duty, you know, and take over.
Well, but like we said, the confrontation that happens with her mother is not the point of the book. You know, the point is just to kind of live with this person who's had trauma and is trying to work through it and trying to navigate a new school and being different, you know, because she has to walk with a cane and she's Welsh, so she doesn't have the posh accent that a bunch of her schoolmates have. And And yeah, it's very, and you can tell it's a kind of a personal book for Joe Walton. And I don't know, I don't think I said up front, but it's a delightful read, and it's an easy read as well. It's not something that you're scratching your head over and like, now what did she mean by that? But I do feel like there's some depth in there as well.
Oh yeah. I think, you know, what she's, the best way to describe this book, it's a love letter.
Yes.
It's a science fiction and fantasy. And I think she even said that during her acceptance speech for Getting at Joe's, that, you know, somebody told her, if you write a love letter to science fiction fantasy, you don't expect anything back. And I think there were reasons this book was popular. I think a lot of people, and myself included, I mean, you just remembered, oh yeah, I was reading that at her age, and I read this and I read that, and oh my God, she's reading it. Because I remember, I think it was about the same age when I started reading Amber, because everybody was talking about the Amber series, which was it was a very different fantasy than your typical medieval fantasy, because you had the whole concept of shadows and Amber being the perfect world, and everything's a reflection of it. And the fact in the second book, you could actually figure out a way how to use gunpowder, and so you're using traditional projectile weapons. And so I think a lot of us were reliving our young reading experiences through that book. And at the same time, kind of emphasizing, and for challenge of being in this really weird, this new environment. I mean, being cut off from everything, and then slowly establishing herself in this new place.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that like right now, 80s nostalgia is real big, right? Where this one is almost like the Stranger Things 10 years earlier, where it's about science fiction up to, probably cutting off at 1979, right? I think there's a portion of the book where we move into 1980, but it's kind of everything up to that point. And so I would definitely say that if you're a well-read science fiction fan who's, in their 40s or 50s, then there's a lot of references in this book that you're definitely going to pick up on. There's a lot of them for me that I thought, okay, yeah, I got that one. No, didn't. I don't know what she's talking about there. But I think, yeah, that probably explains some of the popularity of the book during that year, because it probably hit the voters right in the feels.
Oh, yeah, and both pro and amateur, because, again, it won the Nebula for that year, too.
Yeah.
And, I think you summed it right. It hits you right in the feels. And as I said, it keeps moving. I mean, it's a very quick read. Yeah. I mean, it's not – you don't need to focus on it, and it's first-person narrator. Mm-hmm. And although that whole thing about unreliable narrator, now I got to think about that. I really got to think about that.
Yeah, going back to that, I mean, at the beginning, you kind of have a prologue where her sister is still alive, and they do this bit of magic against this Furnacite factory, I think they called it. And then after that, and she refers to her sister as Moore, and then for the rest of the book, she goes by Moore. And so I was at kind of in the first third of the book, I was like, were there ever really two of them, or is it one of them and like her shadow self or something, or like her fairy self? And we're going to find out later that, I don't know, that there was some mystery there. It didn't pan out, but it was something that was on my mind early in the book. I'm like, is she telling us everything that happened? Because it really slowly kind of spools out what happened to her sister. Cause I don't think you don't get the full story of the car accident until at least halfway into the book, she tells somebody about it. You get little hints of it, but
yeah. And the thing is, you probably have the advantage over that, because this is the second time reading it. So I generally knew what the plot was and where things were going. So I'm rereading it. So I don't remember where to supply. And I do know about the twins. So I don't know if it caught me surprise in the beginning. I mean, because at some point she talks about how she's Morwenna and her sister was Morgana.
Right.
And I think they got that. I think they got their names from their mother who, I forget. Well, the thing is, their last name is, Markova. I've got it here, Markova. Yeah. So I don't know if that's her father's name, or since they divorced, did they go back to their mother's name? Because I forget what the father's called. I mean, he's kind of a.
It was Phelps, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. He had kind of a traditional British name.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that was a conflict of, how, the Welsh, the Welsh and the English are. Although Wales, I actually went to Wales one time to go to the Doctor Who experience, because I'm blanking out on the capital of Wales.
Cardiff?
Yeah, it's in Cardiff, because that's where they make Doctor Who. So they have like a little Doctor Who exhibit museum, and it's just a lovely place.
Hmm.
And it's just, you know, it was just a 2-hour train ride to get over there.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, there is a big cultural divide, just like there is between the English and the Scottish.
Mm-hmm.
And she's contracted, because I guess she's kind of out in the middle of the country. She's kind of in the country when she comes from Wales. She's not coming from the big city, and then
right. She
has to live, you know, near a big city, you know, when she's going to school. So that's a big conflict, you know, between nature and the city.
Yeah. Yep. Well, anything else that you wrote down that you want to talk through?
No, actually, I also did write about Karras, but I forgot about the part where she was wondering about whether it came from. I just thought she found her own Karras, and that's what, made life more bearable.
Right. But she talks this through with her boyfriend, right? She's like, you might like me because I did magic to make you like me. Because they talk about this several times, that it's very easy with magic to make people do something they kind of already wanted to do anyway. And then they don't even know that they've had magic done against them. And he goes through that exercise with her where he's like, well, do you acknowledge that we could break up right now? That we could go our separate ways? And she's like, yes, I recognize that we could have a big fight and break up. And he said, well, then it wasn't magic, because we could break up. If it was magic, we wouldn't be able to. And she's not totally satisfied with that explanation, but I thought it was a good boyfriend move.
And it's actually, he's very cool, because he doesn't automatically dismiss her when she talks about magic, or at least he doesn't pull a Darren Stevens on her, which is what I always call it. he doesn't put her down. I mean, that was something that later on when I was thinking about that show, whether we're talking about the old Bewitched show, because the guy says, don't do any witchy stuff, you know, and it's like, and he's a little bit more open, or at least he's trying to say, well, prove it, you know, and I thought, you know, and I think that's kind of a more good way, you know, you don't, particularly since he does believe it strongly, and we as the audience know that it's at least magic in some form is real.
Right.
And, you know, we don't want him to be a jerk and be completely dismissive of it. And he wants to just see, he wants there to be proof. And, you know, and obviously he challenges her for it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and again, he's open to the idea, you know, he's open to that there might be more to this world than there is to know.
Yeah.
And again, we, the audience, know that there is.
Yes. So I will say that by way of recommending this, I think this would be a good book to read on a plane, just because it's in those journal entries, you know, and so it just keeps you turning the pages, because there's no chapter divisions. So like I read this on my Nook, and in a typical book, it's got chapters, and if you just kind of tap on it, it'll tell you how many pages left in the chapter. And this one just always said, you know, 220 pages left in this chapter, because it didn't actually subdivide along the journal entries. It didn't have, like, they didn't start new pages on those. And so I was always just like, I'm just going to read one more and then I'm going to bed, you know? And then I'd read five more, and then I'd be like, okay, I gotta stop now.
Yeah. I mean, I also reread this on my phone, in a PDF format, and it showed that it just depends on how I feel, and not necessarily the book material, about whether I can get through, because sometimes I don't know if staring at a screen at print that size sometimes taxes on me, because some days I was doing really good at making progress, and then there's some days where it just went dirt slow, and it just might have been, you know, how much sleep I got the night before or how much stuff I got to do. But yeah, I mean, it is. I remember when I had it in book form, it was actually a very, I mean, I didn't want to put it down. You just wanted to know, even though it's not really a plot driven book, I don't think so, because there's no, there's small action, but there's no big action.
Right.
Like say in the Leviathan Wakes, obviously you do have a bunch of action sequences there and you have a big climax at the end, but this is just like small stuff. I mean, you know, you want to see her, you are rooting for Morgana to succeed. She's got the audience on her side.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You care about her.
Yeah. You care about her. And you're hoping for the best for it. And it keeps you moving.
Yep. Cool. Well, any final thoughts on this one? I mean, I guess we kind of were doing that.
I think it just something just popped up into me is like, you know, Joe Walton or Morgana was reading the list of the stuff that, you know, got her through that time in her life. And but we all have lists like that, and they're going to be different lists, and they're just as worthy for them. Somebody 20 years from now will have a different list, and it's just as effective. And enjoy your lists. Enjoy that time. Enjoy those works and how they get you through it.
Well said. I like it. Yeah, this was a fun one. So I want to thank you for suggesting this one.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I hesitate because you know, if anybody, your fans know, you've got this website of like, you know, you got on the website all the books and who's already like earmarked some of them for. And I go, of course, somebody goes, oh, they've already picked that. Oh, they picked that one. And it's like,
yeah.
And as I said, I wanted something relatively recent and something I had. I think I definitely voted for this one to be number one. For those of you who don't know how the Hugos are voted, it's using the Australian balloting system, which is it's very complicated. But the big thing is you rate everything from first to last place, and you also have the option to put no award in that ranking. So I definitely know. I just remembered reading this. I'd have to take a look at my ballot, but I'm pretty sure I ranked this number one. The only other thing that I really got into was Deadline.
Yeah, you mentioned that series. I looked it up while you were talking about it, and I'm like, oh, I remember seeing that book Feed, right? That's the first book in that.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at it and going, ah, you know what? I would like to read that at some point. Well, any contact information or anything you want to promote before we sign off?
Well, if you're in Florida, if you're in Central Florida, please check us out at the Orlando Area Science Fiction Society. We make a safe space. We are the book club to create a safe space to discuss science fiction. We're looking at whether we can. We occasionally put on a convention. Right now, we're just counting up, seeing how we did the last convention. We're still scratching our heads and going over the budgets and stuff.
Nice.
So check out the Orlando Area Science Fiction Society if you're in the Central Florida area. And you can find me on Twitter at Rainbow War. If you just look up Rainbow War 71, you should be able to find me. I try to be interesting as much as possible. And if you go to Worldcon, you'll be seeing me running around to get from place to place, particularly to get to the Guests of Honor discussions. That's amazing. When I'm at Worldcon in recent years, I got to prioritize seeing all the Guests of Honor programming, since that's the most unique programming and we're honoring somebody. And there was a lot of really good stuff this year with John Scalzi interviewing Diane Duane and Ian McDonald being interviewed. And just a lot of fun and work. And just say hi if you see me.
Nice. Sounds good. Well, I'll put any links that I can find into the show notes.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really want to thank you for doing this one and for reaching out. You know, you were one of the early people who sent me a message on Facebook, or not on Facebook, on Twitter, just letting me know somebody was out there and had found the show. So that was cool.
Thank you. You're welcome. It was just great. This is great. And I was, oh God, that's an ambitious idea.
Yeah, I figured if I was going to set up a podcast, I might as well do one that it's going to take me a few years to get through. So thanks again, man. And I'm sure we'll talk more on Twitter down the line. Take care.
We will. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Juan, and I'll put his contact information in the show notes if you want to go hit him up on Twitter. As always, I do invite you, if you're enjoying the show, to go ahead and leave a rating for us in Stitcher or Google Play or Apple Podcasts or however you listen to us. And if you would like to support the work that I do here and on my other podcasts, you can go to patreon.com/hugospodcast and sign up to support it. All right, I think that'll do it for this time. Talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.